Let me see your eyes. Is everything all right?
Yes, Marina. Why you ask?
You make me sad, Lalo. I have to come to Gringolandia to find this out. You thought I wasn't gonna notice $3 million and 7 of my men dead? Since when do you take decisions of your own? I made you. I did.
I'm very sorry, Madrina. It was stupid of me not to tell you right away. You know, I just wanted to prove to you that it was a Cheech and Chong were stealing your money. So please, allow me to talk to them.
Yes, and man will say anything to stop the pain. You're stupider than you look.
Opening July 6th, the film Savages is a tough, exhilarating crime drama that recalls the tone of director Oliver Stone's best work. The film, starring Blake Lively, John Travolta, Salma Hayek, and Benicio del Toro, tells the story of a close-knit group of three young pot growers who tangle with a cutthroat Mexican cartel. Savages is based on a novel by best-selling author Don Winslow. When Oliver Stone optioned Mr. Winslow's incredibly captivating and cinematic work, he brought on Mr. Winslow to co-author the screenplay as well. Mr. Winslow's prequel to his book Savages, titled The Kings of Cool, has just been released in hardcover. What really interests me, first of all, I'm sure it's different for everyone, but generally, when you're a writer of fiction as you are, what is your relationship to movies? I mean, is it kind of a double-edged sword?
Used to be. I think I've changed the way I viewed this over the past few years. You know, I think that most, you know, novelists tend to go in one of two broad streams regarding the world of film. You know, the first one is to say, yeah, I'll sell or I'll option my stuff and I'll take the money and run, you know, mm-hmm. and have nothing to do with it. And then the second stream is to be more involved with it. I used to be one of the first, you know. And then I had a movie made that didn't turn out, you know, as well as we'd hoped. And that really changed the way I approached the world of film. So now I do pay more attention to it. I want to be more involved. I want to have a meaningful seat at the table, you know. You know, as a novelist, that you're never going to have anything like complete control. And I'm not sure I'd want that even, mm-hmm. You know, because at the end of the day, it's famously, you know, a director's medium. But I have gotten, you know, definitely more involved with the films.
Well, what went wrong with this was the Life and Death of Bobby Z? Was that the previous film? Or?
Yeah, exactly. The Death and Life of Bobby Z, which came out as a film titled Bobby Z. Yeah, you know, look, I mean, nobody ever sets out to make an unsuccessful film, you know, mm-hmm. with the best intentions in the world. But it happened, and I think it happened because of some, you know, issues that I'd already identified, you know. But people would say to me, well, you know, you're a novelist, you're not a filmmaker, you don't understand. Yeah, there's some truth to that argument, and I kind of bought the logic of that argument, but I don't think the logic of that argument is total, you know, and mm-hmm. I think that there are some elements of storytelling that remain the same across both media. And so, you know, having had that experience, you know, I hooked up with my buddy Shane Salerno, who's an A-list screenwriter, and he has this company called The Story Factory that has some pretty, you know, good ideas about the nexus between the film and the book worlds and how to bring the novels to film in a more sort of creative, careful way.
Well, I definitely want to talk to you about that, those two different disciplines, for writing for the novel and writing for film.
Yeah.
But first of all, to set up Savages, Oliver Stone optioned this book, and he requested that you come on board as co-screenwriter?
He did, yep, that Shane and I come on board, and that's what we did, you know. And so, I mean, that's major involvement, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did he feel like,
when you envision the kind of the ideal directors for this particular material, I mean, did he feel like he fit just right in your mind from the get-go?
Yeah, this was Shane's idea, you know, and thought that this was sort of right in Oliver's wheelhouse, and the kind of film that, that Oliver, you know, hadn't made in a couple of years, and that he would respond to the material.
Well, in terms of the process of adapting a screenplay from your own book, it seems like it would be a very torturous one, because you can't necessarily be too precious about your own work, because it won't necessarily fit into a narrative film structure. Was that a difficult process for you?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting kind of compromise, because you're quite right. You have to detach yourself a little bit from being the novelist, because I think either consciously or perhaps subconsciously, you do become attached to certain, you know, story elements or character elements that may or may not work for film. And I think that you have to be, you know, somewhat open and flexible to that possibility. At the same time, you want to protect the essence of the book,
right?
You know, and the essence of the characters and the main story and the sort of main identity of who those characters are. So it's a tricky path to walk.
Yeah. Well, tell me about this world that you created in Savages and that you continue on with the Kings of Cool, your prequel book that just came out. Where did this knowledge of these lifestyles come from for you?
Well, you know, both books are about two young marijuana growers and their mutual girlfriend in Laguna Beach, California. And in Savages, you meet them rather late in their arc. And they grow the best marijuana going, and the Mexican cartel wants to take them over, and bad things happen. To answer the question, I guess, that you asked me, you know, I lived in that area. I still frequent that area a lot, hang out on the beach, you know, get to know people, hear stories, hear snatches of dialogue and conversation. So a lot of it was a matter of looking and listening and talking to people, you know, over the course of years, really. And so when I sat down to write, you know, both these books, I already had a very, very strong idea about who these people were, how they spoke, how they behaved, what they did. I hasten to add, I'm not a marijuana grower or even a user, for that matter. So it doesn't come from personal experience in that regard.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, imagination plays a big role.
It plays some role, you know, but I mean, I think that that research, you know, plays a lot of the role.
Dennis, we need your files on the Baja cartel.
Have a nice day.
Dennis, you step out that car. I'm coming down to San Diego to introduce myself to your district supervisor.
You have a hard time explaining $500,000 parked in the Cook Islands when you clear 110 after taxes. Names, history, stash
that
houses.
That ain't part of the deal, buddy boy.
It is now.
It don't work that way.
We're running out of time, Dennis. You have to step up right now.
You know what? I'm out of here.
What the hell are you doing?
They took our girl, and I will do anything to get her back. Do you understand me?
Tell me about their manner of speaking as it's expressed in the actual prose in the book as well as the dialogue. It has such a musicality to it. I mean, did that just flow out of you from the get-go when you started writing?
I certainly wanted it to have an element of musicality to it. I think some of it flowed, and some of it was a matter of, you know, what we always do is rewriting and going back in and listening to rhythms. I know that I drove copy editors insane, you know, because I would have these odd, for instance, indents where, you know, a new sentence would start, you know, not six spaces in, but 13, and I wanted it at 13 and not at 12, because, you know, I definitely heard a certain kind of music to it, you know, and wanted the beats to fall where I wanted them to fall. So a lot of that was the crafting that writers always do, going back and rewriting. Other parts of what I think you're referring to, you know, was just, I really heard this book in my head, and I heard these books as sort of a new kind of voice that I'm hearing out here on the West Coast, you know, as it evolves.
And it's such a strong voice and a strong style to these two books. And I'm thinking about, you know, the great actors that that immerse themselves in a particular role and particular world, and they have a hard time shaking it. I know you're working on multiple books at one time. Was this a hard kind of voice to shake for you?
You know, no, not really. What an interesting question, though. No, I don't think so. I think, you know, pretty disciplined about my writing, you know, in the hours that I write, and then pretty disciplined about leaving it behind.
Yeah.
You know, and going out and doing other things. Now, you know, I mean, a lot of times I'll do literally a physical break. You know, if I was writing Savages, I'd set it down, then I'd go out and walk or walk, run, you know, for a few miles or go out down to the ocean and swim or, you know, catch a few waves or whatever. And that, you know, that really helps you make a transition into something else.
Tell me about the how involved you were in the actual production. I mean, were you present on set at all?
Yeah, I was present on set sometimes, certainly not all the time. I was present at location scouts and that kind of thing, and you know, and talking about, you know, various issues of the film. But a lot of it for me was showing people around, you know, these areas and showing
mm-hmm.
them where various events in the book actually took place, and you know, and trying to give them a sense of that world.
Yeah. And the actors, that the sensational cast of this film, it's incredible.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that a lot of them, and as well as being attracted to working with Stone, I mean, they're attracted mm-hmm. to the prospect of sinking their teeth into these great, vivid characters. I mean, did they, when you see the film now, what about it surprises you from what you had in your head?
You know, it's always strange to see something that existed as this little idea when you're sitting at a desk several years ago, you know, and then you suddenly, you know, either on the set see real people acting it out or on the screen, you know, you see it big and tall and kinetic and bright and all of that kind of thing that never fails to be simultaneously a little jarring and of course exciting, you know. So I don't know if there are any particular surprises, you know, because, you know, I was involved in the process, but it's always kind of startling. And it's funny because you forget what you didn't do. I was watching the trailer with Shane one day, and there was a line in it. What was it? Oh, if you let people think you're weak, sooner or later you're going to have to kill them. And I said, Shane, that's a really good line. And he started to laugh. He said, it's in the book. And, you know, I forgot. that was my line as opposed to, you know, ours or
yeah.
his or, you know,
yeah.
ours or whatever. So it's kind of funny how it can blend in your head, you know.
I like talking to you, Ophelia. But let me remind you that if I had to, I wouldn't have a problem cutting both their throats.
Well, you'll never get them together. I'm the only one who can do that.
Come on. Are you really bragging about that? There's something wrong with your love story, baby. They may love you, but they will never love you as much as they love each other. Otherwise, they wouldn't share you, would they?
When you sat down to kind of devise your second book, the Kings of Cool, the
mm-hmm.
I guess it's the kind of the prequel to Savages.
Yeah, it is.
What was the main attraction? Because a large part of the book kind of traces a multi-generational
right.
Aspect. Was that the main
yeah.
draw for you?
That was the main draw. I wanted to write a book about families, oddly mm-hmm. enough, and the choices that one has to make. I mean, the sort of central, you know, story of the Kings of Cool is about these guys having to make choices between their blood family, you know, their biological families, and the family that they've created amongst these very close friends. And I think those are difficult and tough choices, and that's at the heart of that book. At the same time, I wanted to do kind of a larger book than Savages and tell a longer story that was an origin story, and not necessarily just an origin story of those three characters, but in a way, sort of an origin story about two other things, the evolution of the drug trade out here in Southern California, mm-hmm. and also, you know, a little bit about the journey that the country has taken, you know, over the years, you know, from the counterculture beginnings to today. And so that was really attractive to me and really drove the story.
What was the main difference for you in kind of tracing the California from decades ago to where it is today? What kind of a different world is it?
Well, it's virtually unrecognizable, I think. Well, you know, I shouldn't say that. I mean, some things remain the same. Look, the ocean's always going to be the ocean, and that's the constant here, you know. But, I mean, society has changed so much. The economics have changed. People's aspirations have changed. But what I was really tracking in that book, I think, you know, was the evolution from idealism, you know, to cynicism, almost naive idealism of the hippie era. To the cynicism, I think, that exists today, you know, among the same people. And so I think, you know, that really has been the change where you've gone from communes to real estate.
You know, we talk about that a lot on the show. And, I mean, it's something that we see in our world, and particularly our country, but it's also reflected in our movies today, because if you think of the films of decades ago, they were concerned with the world around them. They were commenting on them, even in a subversive way. But today, right, there seems to be an apathy.
I think it's an apathy born of fatigue. I think we've been sort of worn down, you know, by any number of crises. And you know, certainly 9/11, I think, had a lot to do with that. And then, you know, the 2008 economic plunge and the things that we've done to ourselves. I think that there's a fatigue about the world. You know, it's funny you mentioned that. I had this conversation with someone the other day saying you could track the mood of the country by the illicit drug that's in vogue. You know, you do marijuana, then you do LSD, and you've got the hippie psychedelic, you know, free love kind of thing. And then you go into cocaine, you know, which is about money and power and drive, and then, you know, we go to crystal meth, you know. Now, I mean, the biggest drug problem is the legal opium derivatives, like Oxycontin.
Yeah.
And I think maybe people want to go to sleep.
Yeah.
You know, it certainly shows in pop culture, doesn't it?
It does.
You know, I mean, look at what we're watching on TV. The other night I had that HBO show on Newsroom.
Yeah,
and it was about being engaged, you know, and the show's struggling. I think, I mean, it just got picked up, but you know, it you looked at those characters, and that's kind of what they were saying. You know, were we ever going to re-engage?
So, talking about the things that engage you, I know that you're working on several additional projects. There's another film on the horizon too, isn't there?
There is, yeah. Just finishing up some notes now on a screenplay of Satori, a book I did that, you know, was a prequel, actually, of a book by, you know, Trevanian. And Shane and I are doing the script for that, and that's Leonardo DiCaprio's attached. And then Chuck Hogan and I, you know, over the town, are talking about doing an original film story together. And that's exciting. And, you know, and then I'm being me, you know, the whole maybe ADD thing, you know, I'm doing three books at the moment.
Wow, I can't imagine compartmental. You have to be a great compartmentalizing.
I am, actually, yeah. It's a little sad. Yeah.
but I want to ask you a question about crime fiction. Because obviously there's an astounding and a long and proud tradition when it comes to crime fiction. So do you kind of hear those voices of the Elroys and that kind of thing in your head when you're writing?
You know, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if I hear them in my head as I'm writing, but, you know, for instance, I mean, I keep a quote from Raymond Chandler on my computer, you know, I mean, taped to the side of the box. You know, down these mean streets must come a man who is not himself me, which I think sort of sets the standard, you know, for the noir hero, you know, even the noir anti-hero. But yes, and I'm very, very aware of coming, you know, out of that stream of writer, and those guys mean a lot to me.
Yeah. Before I let you go, I want to ask you, my co-host, he's in love with your work. He's read everything. And he wanted me to ask you if there are any plans to adapt the Dawn Patrol into a film.
You know, at the moment, no. There's some talk, perhaps, about television.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's an exciting medium for writers. I mean, that in many ways, that's more exciting than film nowadays.
Well, listen, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, the differences are obvious, and they each have their potentials, you know. I mean, I think, you know, with television, you get 26 hours to explore a character.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, as opposed to, you know, a little under two. So, you know, I mean, you look at shows like The Sopranos and The Wire and Friday Night Lights and Rescue Me and some of those shows that, you know, I think were so beautifully written and performed. And yeah, I think it's very interesting.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you, your books are beautiful, and it's a great film.
Man.
And I can't thank you enough. I've been looking forward to talking to you, and I really appreciate it.
I appreciate your time.
Dating back to his film Salvador in 1986, the relationship between Oliver Stone and music supervisor Bud Carr represents one of his longest and most fruitful collaborations. Mr. Carr has amassed a legendary caliber of credits, including Gladiator, Twister, and Michael Mann's Heat. In his work with Oliver Stone, from Born on the Fourth of July, to The Doors, to Any Given Sunday, he has provided a rich tapestry of diverse music that viscerally and vividly illustrate the themes, characters, and settings of each unique film. Savages marks their 18th collaboration.
Having worked with Oliver Stone so many times in your career, how has that collaboration changed and evolved over the years?
Changed, gotten better. Shorthand, you know, understanding when, you know, somebody says, a direction. That it, you know, any relationship evolves based on, you know, on understanding and trust, and we have that. He'll allow me to be stupid, and not be afraid of trying things that maybe in a newer relationship with other directors I'm sometimes a little hesitant about.
Mm-hmm.
With him, there's no hesitancy. I mean, I have no problem sending him, you know, off-the-wall ideas, both musically and artistically, because he challenges me with that. I mean, you know, a lot of the things that we've done together over the years in song choices or composer choices really have not been the obvious. He's anything but obvious, but there are times that the song selections, you know, I kind of go, I don't know, but I'm not afraid to, you know, I'm not afraid to make those ideas, and I'm not afraid of the criticism. So I think that the evolution of the relationship on a collaborative level has been great.
Mm-hmm. And on something like The Savages, where does your work really begin? Does it begin when you get the script, or how does your work really begin in terms of a project like this?
With him, you know, he allows me in very early. You know, once he's comfortable with the script, I get it. I get to read it, and I get to just, you know, be on my own with it. And, you know, I usually start to pile up music. Now certainly a lot easier, you know, than, you know, I was going through some vinyl the other day and realized, wow, that's how I used to do this. You know, it's just,
right.
You know, you waited for the LPs to come in, or you got them out of your collection. I mean, now, you know, the resource is immediate. If you get an idea about an artist or a song, I mean, with Spotify and Pandora and all these services, I mean, you can just go listen and dive
right.
in and so the immediacy of having an idea is a lot easier. So I'll start with that, you know, and then we'll usually sit down, you know, before he starts shooting. Sometimes he is on Wall Street too. He was very, you know, conceptually specific early on. And on Savages, I mean, you know, he just said, we may not score this movie with score. We may just do it with songs. I want to go the gamut. I want Mexican. I want hip hop. I want, you know, classical. I want, you know, current. I want classic songs. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. So, I mean, you know, you walk out of the meeting like that and go, okay, you know, I can go do that. I mean, it's, you know, the challenge. I mean, I often tell people I get paid to listen to music. I mean, you know, if I ever told my dad you know, by the way, when I grow up, I'm going to listen to music and watch films and get paid for it, right? You know, I'm pretty sure that I don't think it would work today. It didn't, certainly wouldn't work then, but that's, you know, God's blessed me with that opportunity. So, I mean, that's how we start. That's how we start. And mm-hmm. and then along the way, he will become attached to things. He is a voracious listener. I mean, you know, I'm blessed with a guy who you know, if you know, and he still uses CDs because he listens to a lot of stuff in the car. So, you know, it's not the iPod kind of a thing because his organization structure is much more specific. He'll mm-hmm. listen to CDs and make notes on them, but we'll start to compile a list of songs, and the editors, when, you know, and he starts with his picture editors, you know, when he starts shooting. So we'll have a hard drive of songs Oliver likes. That doesn't mean they'll ever find a home, but for example, in this movie, Romance in Durango, is a 3 months, you know, or 2 months before shooting idea, and it ended up in the movie. I mean, would that be where I put it? I don't know. I mean, I ended up seeing that scene with the song in it and kind of went, oh, cool, that worked. You know, it's kind of like, right. So, you know, so the editors get a lot of that material based on the things he likes. And a lot of the things that ended up in the movie were things that he got attached to during shooting. He likes to listen to things during shooting. He'll play stuff on the set. And so it's a consciously progressive, you know, thing. And that, I hope anyway, I know he feels that it doesn't seem pasted on at the end. You know, it kind of like finds its way to deserve to be there. I mean, we've used songs in scenes and just thrown them out and kind of said, you know, he'll say to me, what were you thinking? Or I'll say to him, what were you thinking? You know, I mean, in other words, it was what we thought that would do, but it doesn't work anymore. So the picture the scene tells us.
Mm-hmm. How would you compare The Savages with some of his other work? How do you think it holds up and kind of adds to his extensive resume?
It's back into U-Turn and Natural Born Killers. It's much more texturally Oliver the filmmaker. I mean, the other work that we've done, I mean, certainly love, you know, I don't think there's a movie we've done that I don't like, which is, you know, kind of fun to have done. But he always gets his actors to show up on camera. And, I mean, to see Travolta and Benicio del Toro, you know, verbally play with each other, it's just great. And he's the kind of guy who sets the stage for that stuff to happen. You know, he makes his actors do their homework. He provides the resources for those actors. I mean, I remember when he was doing Platoon. I mean, those guys did, you know, 3 weeks of boot camp before they started to shoot. I mean, they were in the mud, and, you know, I mean, those actors were, you know, went through that. And he provides the resources for that kind of material. So as a director, it's fun to watch that happen.
Oh, I can imagine. And your work is so extensive. I mean, you work with so many great visionary directors, from Michael Mann, James Cameron, Frank Oz, Terry George. I mean, all these directors. What is one thing that you think all of them have in common?
Trite to say, passion. You know, I mean, that's a very... But... you walk in a room with those men and you realize that committing to direct a motion picture is a gargantuan task. I mean, you know, if you think picking out knobs for the kitchen cabinets is a task that you may not want to do with your wife, I mean, imagine everything that these guys have to decide or choose from. But those guys you just mentioned, they know when they take on the task of what the challenge is, and it's fascinating to be a fly on the wall. I mean, you know, in general they all see the trees. You know, I mean, for the rest of us, it's a really cool forest. But they, and I mean, I've had Oliver, you know, point out to me, and Terry George did it as well. But don't you see that right there? I mean, how can you do this with it? And you kind of look at it and go, oh, right, that, right there. No, I didn't see it. It's as obvious as anything and probably most important thing in the scene, but for some reason or other, as a director, they see it, and eventually I think as a moviegoer, the audience sees it. So, I mean, that's their ability to point out for, you know, any of us that work for them. And last, I think every one of those guys, or majority of the guys that I've worked to, they get the best work out of the people that show up. Oliver's really good at that. I mean, you see it from his cinematographers, from his editors, from the sound. You know, when they show up for work, they're all really talented. But right. for some reason or other, they bring it. You know, and I think that's the key to a great director is getting the people around them to show up and do their best work.
And I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about Michael Mann's Heat, which it seems like it's such a atmospheric and really, you know, epic film. Talk to me about that project, and was, I can imagine it was a very daunting project for you being a part of that, but also very rewarding.
Kid in a Candy Store. you know, he is consumed with making motion pictures, and this was truly one of the most amazing experiences I've had in my career. I mean, you know, all the work with Oliver is amazing, and those I certainly, you know, would put I have to put this one on a par with a lot of those experiences. And don't quote me when you say that, or Oliver will kill me. Michael challenges you and challenged me musically, and I'll give you what I mean. The first day we met, and it was close to the end of he was going into final production, and he said, "Okay," he said, "I want three songs that I approve for every scene in the movie, cleared and ready to have on the stage. And by the way, I want you to get the artists to give us the 24-track multi-tracks to every song, so if I want to remix them while we're there, we can do it."
Oh, wow.
And I know I say stupidly because it's not fair, but I went, oh, cool. It's like I left the room and went, that's ridiculous. But I mean, you know, but then again, you know, I mean, Moby, which was the end track in that movie, and he's such a lovely man. You know, we had his multi-track on the stage. We also did I think it was a 90-piece orchestral version of that, and had all of those multi-tracks. I had eight music editors working for me on that movie, and we just played. The Kronos Quartet. One of the things that's not in the movie is the bank heist was scored. In the movie, there's no music, but there's a Kronos Quartet and guitar symphony that was done for that scene that made it look like a ballet. And
wow.
It was wonderful, but it took you out of the movie, and it was like a ballet and a music video, and come on, we're stealing money and shooting people. Great project, another example of a guy. I mean, you know, I didn't sleep much because it kind of wasn't about, you know, the pressure of doing the work. It was kind of, you know, every time you got an idea, you got a better one. And
right.
in this particular instance, there were no bad ideas. They were just the other idea.
And going backwards, according to IMDb, it says that your first film in terms of doing music on was a Terminator. Is that correct? Was that your first project?
Yes.
What was it like being thrown into a film like that with James Cameron as your first film? I'm sure that had to be like, you know, the best train you could have right off the bat.
I had absolutely no idea what I was doing, you know, and I think possibly that was helpful. What I do for a living, I mean, is problem solving. Yes, it's musically driven, but it's problem solving. And Jim and Gail made that movie. I think research will tell you. I think it was $6 million that they made it for. Mm-hmm. And literally, Gail Hurd carried the camera for the last scene that they shot with the Jeep going off. So there wasn't a lot of money. And the lawyer that represented me at that time, I was in artist management, also represented the company that produced the picture, Hemdale. And I was introduced to the producer and, you know, basically said, you know, oh, so you're one of those management types, you know. And it was basically they couldn't get any of their phone calls returned to license the songs that Jim wanted. The Police and I can't remember who else at this particular point, but there were 8 or 9 songs in that movie that they wanted. Prince was one of them. And, and you know, my job was to just get those people to return somebody's call about it. And, you know, and Arnold Schwarzenegger certainly at that particular point was coming off of Conan, and, you know, this really wasn't a serious project. And I got all the guys, you know, who most of which I knew to return my call and give me quotes and clear songs. And then the studio, Mike Medavoy, God bless him, you know, who's an amazing producer, was then at Orion. And I had known him from the agency days. And he said, what are you thinking? We don't have the money for these songs. And I said, so I went and did this and you didn't have any money? He said, no. So, again, I'm telling you, I had no idea what I was doing. So I just went home and opened my drawer and took some cassettes out of friends of mine and put together some songs and sat down with Jim. And you know, we ended up paying next to nothing for the songs that are in that movie. And he loved them. And every one of those people are very, very happy because their bank accounts are much, much bigger because they licensed songs for little or nothing and made money on the backside. So
I guess it's taught you how to improvise on your feet, right?
very well put. You know, I mean, every time you think you have a solution, you can count on the fact that it you know, it's not what's going to eventually happen. So you better. I mean, the sense of authorship is lovely, but in this particular situation, it's all about finding the right thing for the person whose vision it is, you know, whether it's Jim or Oliver or Michael, you know, they have something in mind and, you know, if it can't be X, I mean, they go through it. I mean, they plan to cast so-and-so for a role and they don't get it and they get somebody else and all of a sudden, you know, they get credit for the most amazing casting idea in history, right?
Yeah.
The same thing happens with songs. I mean, we can, you know, work forever. I mean, it will go unmentioned, but there's one song that isn't in Savages that was in Savages up until, gosh, and we were dubbing, and the artist just eventually said no. And, you know, it was like death, you know, and Oliver looks at me, you've let me down, you've disappointed me. And he didn't really mean that, but I mean, and the song that is currently in the scene is perfect, and he loves it, and he goes, why the hell are we thinking about that other song? So, I mean, in other words, eventually, you know, things deserve their place.
Oh, definitely. And my final question for you is, of course, tomorrow is the 4th of July, and today, the Born on the 4th of July was re-released, I believe, on a Blu-ray DVD digital copy. What do you remember about that film? Which I think that's my favorite Oliver Stone film of all time.
I remember... Well, Ron Kovic, first of all, who Oliver introduced me to when we started the movie. You know, I would not go without saying that he was inspirational for me, just to meet him and to sit with him. And I've seen that movie recently on on cable somewhere. It's like one of those things when you wake up in the middle of the night and you can't go to sleep, you turn on stuff and you start flipping channel. And I ended up watching, I got it from the beginning. I ended up watching the entire movie, and the colors of that picture, the cinematography, the texture, is wonderful. So two stories. If you have time, I'll tell you two stories.
I have all time in the world. Yeah, plenty.
Back to Ron Kovic. Moon River in that movie is the song that Ron Kovic danced to at his prom.
Oh wow.
Yeah, take a deep breath to that man who's now in a wheelchair. So whatever I could do to get that song and get it licensed was there. And then the Creedence song that has the line, the 4th of July in it, that's in the bar scene. And I'm spacing on the title of the song because it's just where I'm at right now. We ended up having to record that particular band who did it on camera literally Thanksgiving weekend. For some reason, they changed the shooting schedule. I flew down to Texas. These guys had never heard the song before. I don't know how that's possible, but that was the case. So I found myself in the studio singing a guideline for the lead singer so that he could eventually do it. And they ended up really doing a good job, and it was a two-day shoot, and they were on camera. And I had to get them prepped and learn to lip sync and do the things they were doing. So I worked for a couple of days and had them on set and that kind of thing. And so we're on set, and Oliver walks in, looks at the band, and goes, "Gosh, they look good." He said, "Bud, teach them Inagata da Vida." And he walked away. Needless to say, they ended up playing the Creedence track. But I mean, that's the kind of environment that movie was around. And Tom, Edie Brickell is on camera in that movie. I don't know. You know who Edie is?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And doing the Dylan cover the kind of sensitivity and sensibility that Oliver has about those moments and how he brings them about and how he becomes engaged with them, allows you those kind of things. We're preparing to shoot that scene, and he's saying it live, and we're sitting in that bar, and Tom walks in, and he's got a jump rope in his hand, and this is right after Dustin Hoffman, Tom Cruise, the movie is Rain Man. It's right after Rain Man, and Tom takes out a jump rope and begins to do 200 reps.
Wow!
with the jump rope, the first AD is called, okay, ready to shoot. Tom gets up, does 200 reps, and sits in the chair. Action.
Wow.
So, that's the Oliver Stone environment. That's the kind of people he brings to these things, and it's I feel blessed.
Adam Peters began his professional career as the keyboardist and cellist of the popular band Echo and the Bunnymen, and went on to collaborate with the likes of Susie and the Banshees and Chrissy Hynde. His unique and sweeping arrangements have always stirred the imagination in such a way that a transition into film composition seemed inevitable. Savages marks Mr. Peters' second collaboration with Oliver Stone, following his work on Stone's documentary, South of the Border.
You come from, obviously, kind of the post-punk London scene, correct?
Yeah, correct.
So that whole, that post-punk kind of London, Manchester music scene is just pretty vital. There's still a lot of vitality to it to this day.
Yeah. There is, isn't there? It was a great thing to grow up in. You know, it's just what I grew up in. So it sort of didn't define me, but it just seemed very natural at the time. Now looking back on it, I'm like, wow, that was kind of a golden age.
What do you remember of that kind of transformation from the kind of that very angry of the punk scene?
Yeah.
But it transformed into kind of the more, I guess you could say, with the dance beats and kind of and so forth, and it just kind of transformed into something even more melodic at the time.
Yeah, well, I think there was two transformations. There was the punk thing, which mm-hmm. I was a little kid then. I was sort of sneaking to the local records shop and buying sort of punk singles and having to sort of wrap them up so my parents wouldn't see them, you know, so I came in at it, you know, just as the first wave of punk, as more like the sort of post-punk thing was starting, what they call now post-punk. We didn't really call it that then. It was just a second wave of stuff. And it just felt like we were all really inspired by the change that happened. Mm-hmm. Because the punk thing was all about, like, you could do it yourself and all that, and sort of like a garage thing. But, you know, I was from I was classically trained.
Oh, okay.
So, for me, it was always about, it just sort of made me want to do something that had never been done before.
Mm-hmm.
So, the whole thing was like every time you came up with a melody or a chord progression or a way of doing something, you were not trying to ape anything. There was this sort of obsessive push for originality. I felt like you could do anything, and like with the Bunnymen, it was a very, you know, it was like Will was really amazing on the guitar, and Matt was really inspiring. It was sort of magical and mystical, and I played with other bands, sort of played with the Banshees, and they were different. They were from the punk time, but I don't know. No, we all felt like we were doing something, creating something. We didn't feel like we were part of anything. It just was that. Like everywhere you went, every bar you went to, every gig you went to. You know, I remember when the birthday party came over from Australia. That was really exciting.
Right.
You know, that was amazing. And then the Berlin lot came over, you know, Neubauten, they were around. And I don't know, it was everywhere. It was in the water, you know. It was that was just what everybody was doing.
And it was one of those deals, more so than the British hardcore punk, but the, you know, what is now, as you said, what is now termed as post-punk, but, you know, wasn't that at the time, that there was kind of a more openness to that music, I guess, here in the States, than, you know, some of the more, I guess you could say, fringe hardcore punk. What did it mean to come over to the States and get kind of that back and forth with kind of, you know, your American contemporaries?
Well, it was great. It was like, you know, it was great. You know, it was like, it was the same deal. I remember coming over and sort of landing in the Danceteria and those kind of places, and there was this groove scene going on, but then there was those bands like Suicide and that were here, and I remember I walked into an elevator in the Gramercy Park Hotel, and I got in and Bob Dylan and Alan Vega were in the lift, and I was like, oh, this is amazing. It was sort of, it was great. It was, it just felt not, it sort of bit, America felt a bit more like an outpost.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it was cool in the major cities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, New York, Boston, and over on the West Coast. But it was sort of not quite like that everywhere else.
Right.
I mean, yeah, you definitely felt like you were flying a flag somehow. I mean, I suppose we kind of felt like that in England. We were very uppity about it. We were like, hey, fuck you and all your Emerson, Lake and Palmer, you know.
I'll second that. Well, and as you're growing up, and so you're into the you're a musician and you're in the groups and so forth. But I was wondering, you know, in the 80s in particular, there was this real kind of acceleration of music being used in movies.
Yeah.
You know, and contemporary music. You know, before, you know, it would be movies would use, you know, kind of songs that maybe were like 10 years older or something. But
yeah,
then,
what's up with that?
Yeah.
Why was he, yeah.
But then, but in the 80s, there was, you know, an acceleration of, no, let's use, particularly when we had, you know, movies about teenagers, well, let's play with, you know, let's do the soundtracks of what the kids are listening to. And what was it like to get a request like, hey, Hollywood wants to use one of your songs in a movie? I mean,
was it? It was. I mean, it's nice to feel. It's always nice to feel wanted.
Right.
It wasn't. I mean, Hollywood was kind of this distant thing.
Right.
It was. I mean, it was. It was just. Yeah. It was a good. I mean, yeah. We were excited. We were excited because it was kind. Because. They came in and said, "Well, you know, your band's really. We love your band. Can you record something for us?" So that was, you know, we've got to remember in those days it was expensive to go in a recording studio.
Right.
You know, you would do your demos on a cassette, you know, in a rehearsal room, and then you'd go into a recording studio, and that was this sort of holy grail. It was like this magical time. So when people came along and said, "Hey, we'll pay for you to go in the studio," it was like, it was a double-edged great thing, you know, because not only was it going into a film, and so that was exciting.
Well, now, and you're, I mean, obviously you're obviously doing film scores and so forth.
Yeah.
But I'm and now it is so ubiquitous. You know, every band, you know, that's kind of part of the game plan now. It's like, well, we need to get your song, you know, either into a movie or in. Or now it's even into a commercial, and you know,
yeah.
You know, commercials have kind of become the new radio to a certain extent now. But I'm wondering, you know, back then, was there any resistance? You know, and now bands have an approval. Well, I don't want my song used here.
One would put the stuff in a commercial back then.
Right.
You would just say no because you'd say that's a bullshit thing to do. It's, you know, it's sort of aligning yourself with all the wrong powers.
Do you still feel that way sometimes, or do you still feel that way?
I don't really think about it. I don't really think it's not important to me anymore.
Right.
I've taken my battles elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I've turned my battles into sort of something more creative somehow.
Right.
You know, when you're a teenager, it's like you're kind of. You're flying your flag and you're saying, you know, but, and I understand why bands want to do it now, because there's no way they can make any money doing what we used to do. So, you know, they're looking at income streams and that, but
yeah.
I mean, I do feel that I don't really know what's going on in that world anymore, because I'm not finding it as relevant somehow.
Right.
And I'm sure there's great stuff. I'm sure somewhere there's somebody in a band doing great stuff. It's just that the way it's all being co-opted into the mainstream, and it gets co-opted so fast because of the internet and, you know, sort of professional tastemakers and stuff like that. That what was great about it was that it was this sort of special place that we all had.
Mm-hmm.
And it's... Maybe, I don't know what it is. I don't know where that place is anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know. I don't know. So I can't really tell you. Does that make any sense?
No, I appreciate. No, I appreciate your thoughts. I mean, I think. I mean, I think there is some validity to your. I guess I'll categorize it as maybe skepticism. Of what's going on today. But well, and to bring it into the movies, so I mean, so you were a musician and so a musician, bands and all that, and so
yeah.
How did you get in? Did you send out feelers that you wanted to do a movie, or did they approach you? How did that come about?
Well, ever since the Bunnymen days, I'd always wanted to end up just writing. and composing. And I moved to Los Angeles 3 or 4 years ago with the express desire to do that. And I, one of the first people I met here was an editor called Elisa Bonora, who was editing a documentary for Oliver. And I was just sort of, I was introduced to her, was chatting, and I didn't know anyone in LA. I mean, no one was, I mean, maybe a few old phone numbers from being here on tour or something, but, you know, not phone numbers I wanted to call, probably. And,
mostly old girlfriends, but you don't want to call them.
Yeah, basically. And so, yeah, Elisa was lovely, and I'd sent her some music and didn't really think much of it, and then she got back to me and said, oh, she wanted to use the music in this documentary. She played it for Oliver, and he loved the music. So my relationship with Oliver sort of began like that.
Well, tell me about your first official meeting with Oliver. What was that like, meeting Oliver Stone for the first time? Here's the guy that did the movie. You know, of all things, he did the movie. Not only does he do the movie The Doors, one of the, you know, definitive rock biopics, but then, you know, you look at what Trent Reznor did with the Natural Born Killer soundtrack.
Yeah.
It's pretty,
I mean, I found it very natural. Mm-hmm. I've got to say, Oliver, the sort of step from my old world to the new world, everyone's like, oh, isn't it weird meeting Oliver? I was like, no, actually, it's not. I mean, I found Oliver to be on the same, pretty much on the same wavelength. I mean, he's very, you know, he's very inspiring and he's very intense. And there's about 8 people in one head. I found it quite invigorating that, as opposed to what everybody tells me about what Hollywood's like and this and that and what they think, you know, I was like, okay, I'm going to make up my own mind. And I found that talking with Oliver was great. And you could talk about stuff in a very deep level, in an intelligent, creative way, which is something that I had been actually missing towards the end of my days in the pop world, rock world, whatever world that is. And he talked about ideas and themes and ideas that he has of, you know, and we were actually talking about some other TV show that he's been doing. And he talked in a way that I found sort of very evocative. I think one of the reasons I really like working with him is that when we talk about stuff, we talk about these sort of distant places up in the cosmos, and then I go off and write, and I go to those places or reach for them, and that's kind of how our process starts.
How is your score working in tandem? And I'm wondering, was this during the process, or was this something Oliver kind of figured out on his own? Because not only is there your score as one element on the soundtrack, but then he also uses source music.
What I wanted to do with the score was make the score blend with the source music.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the score is like score. There's orchestral score,
right.
And then there's synth score with bits of guitars or stuff over it. And then there's other bits of the score that are just sort of more ambient bits. And then some of the score is me writing what sounds like a source track. And I just felt on this film that I know Oliver loves that thing. He loves that sort of riot of collision of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that Oliver is quite a classic person as well. He's sort of a melancholic romantic, and he's a very brave filmmaker, and he does these sort of mad collisions of stuff. But he does have a really strong head for structure and the sort of old classics of cinema. And I wanted this score to retain the postmodern thing that he uses, but I wanted it to be more thematic than just sort of random pieces of music sort of coming in. So I tried to sort of draw it together so you don't really notice it. It still feels like it's shifting abruptly and going all over the place, but it actually has a thread to it that you don't hear, but it keeps you in the movie.
One of the elements is that there's this kind of south of the border Mexican flavor to parts of the score, and then there's this kind of more, I guess you could say, you know, American kind of, you know, Southern California kind of elements. And so I'm kind of wondering, you know, what did you do to keep that balanced?
Well, I wrote different. I mean, when we had our first conversations, Oliver was explained the way he saw it was this, to have this idea of this idyllic place that's obviously not idyllic. In Laguna Beach, this sort of strange, wealthy, beautiful sort of whatever it is there. So I wanted to set that up musically and then have this dark cloud that was coming from over the border towards it. And so, I mean, that was a sonic thing, and I just used the sort of beachy sounds for Laguna with the guitar, but I still had this element of unease to it. I actually took a conversation that we had when we were having one of the spotting sessions, because I record everything when we're talking, so I can go back and listen and sort of reevaluate what we've actually been talking about. So I took one of those conversations and treated it sort of synthetically and turned it into a sort of keyboard pad and had it playing in the background. So you have this sort of sound that's going on. You can't quite put your finger on, like, why are we in this strange place? Because so I was sort of doing things like that, and then I just used a different sounds, the dark synths and the sort of sparse nylon guitar, to bring the dark cloud over from the border.
When you watch movies, or maybe even now television is really taken off, do you listen to the score differently than you, maybe when
you're before? I do. I mean, I notice it when it's when it's really great. I don't notice it. I just am taken with the whole thing of watching whatever I'm watching.
Mm-hmm.
And when it has holes in it, then I kind of notice them more.
Have you taken upon yourself to, like, kind of go back and maybe start, you know, educating yourself on, like, movie scores?
No, because I don't. I haven't done that. But my studio here in LA is at Hans Zimmer's compound.
Oh, okay.
Where there's a few other composers here. So I'm in that environment,
mm-hmm.
and I see these guys every day, and we, you know, this is my world. So I'm very aware of, you know, I've learned how technically to do it. And it wasn't really that much of a leap, because
right.
the music I was writing before was always based on, it was very sort of image based somehow. I always thought the music was something that had a lot of levels and always should paint pictures. And although the beautiful thing about music is it's invisible. I mean, it's such a simple, complex thing. So, I keep an eye, you know, I've gone back to the classics. You know, I went back and watched Chinatown again the other day, and I was so blown away with it yet again. And I watched it then another couple of times just to really listen to the score, which is a great score. But
well, it's also,
I don't know. I think I sort of try and pull from everywhere. You know, I might be walking down the street and just hear something coming out of a window, and it affects me.
And it's interesting how in the last, I guess, few years, how, you know, musicians, you know, the pop world have gone into, you know, gone into this. I mean, Mark Mothersbaugh did a lot of Wes Anderson scores.
Yeah.
James Murphy from LCD Sound System did the score for Noah Baumbach's Greenberg. And even I think Nick Jones did a bit of a score for a movie called Amongst Friends like 20 years ago. And, you know, to see, you know, this kind of infusion into score, you know, of movie scores with kind of this pop element that seems to pop up every now and then.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's people that do that. I'm not sure if I'm really like that pop guy.
Right,
because I have such a deep classical background. It's like, I understand how it works, but I'm writing a lot more orchestral. I'm writing more orchestrally and trying to sort of fuse all the elements together. I don't think it's something that you can just sort of drop in on.
Right.
Say, hey, I'm going to knock out a movie and then I'm going to go on to... I mean, this is something that on the surface, it looks like it's really easy. Oh, yeah, he was in a band and now he's doing movies. It's really hard.
Right.
And it takes a lot of really hard work. And really to sort of then be able to take your ideas and... When I've written my themes and my atmospheres, and I sort of created this place that where the music lives, and then I'll have like a handful of these ideas. And okay, these are going to be this is the idea for the film. To then turn that into a coherent film score is it takes sort of a lot of concentration and a lot of technical work. To make it sound fluid and effortless, and so it's I see why even people like Stravinsky came here and struggled. You know, I really get it.
Well, and I'll end on kind of a lighter note. I'll ask you this question, two questions. Is there a recent score that a movie that has really kind of really stuck out for you that you really like?
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, I thought that the way they used the Wagner in Melancholia was just amazing.
Oh, yes. That is amazing.
I just thought it was a fantastic film.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I've yet to meet anyone that agrees with me.
It is a polarizing film.
I thought it was wonderful. I just loved it. And I loved the fact that when I went to the cinema, there was one other person in there. And it was a sort of Tuesday afternoon, and I almost felt like I was doing something wrong. I really loved it.
No, but that's a good one. That's a good one.
Yeah.
And then I'll ask you this. So what is next? What is next done? Do you have another film, a score in the pipeline?
I'm just I'm writing some early demos for something that's being shot at the moment. So.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really want to jinx it.
Right.
By talking about it.
And do you hope to see yourself collaborating again with Oliver Stone?
Yeah, I really enjoyed this process. I loved it. It was great, and I think Oliver and I sort of have this. He trusts me now, and I think I understand him somewhat. And I really like him, and I think those relationships, that is why I would like to do more work with him. I think we've sort of begun something that seems to work,
right.
And it's taken a bit of time to sort of build that up. So I don't know, but I don't know. You know, let's see what happens, see what he does, what he wants to do. But it was a really good team. The post production team on Savages was great. I mean, my music editor was fantastic. I learned a lot, and he really helped me a lot, and the and Oliver's editors were great as well. So that's, I mean, that's one of the strange things here in Hollywood. You see these sort of these teams of people sort of spring up for a film, and something very strong and intense happens, and then they dissipate as well. It's like a flower that just sort of is, you know, blooms and then goes. So I really enjoyed working with everybody. So yeah, I'd love to repeat that. And but you don't know what's going on in this town. You never know what's going to happen. You think you might know, but you don't know. There's something new happens every day.
That's it for this episode of Movie Geeks United. Savages opens in theaters on July 6th, and the soundtrack is now available. For more information on Movie Geeks United, including access to over 600 filmmaker interviews with talents like William Friedkin, James Cameron, Francis Ford Coppola, and Brian De Palma, visit our website at moviegeeksunited.net.